Advancing justice, that is our focus today. What does it look like to wage strategic campaigns that compel transnational corporations and, oh, by the way, governments that do their bidding to stop destroying our health, human rights, democracy, and our planet? If those are issues that matter to you, you'll really want to stay here with me to hear what our guests have to say. I'm Gina Murphy-Darling, and this is Impact Earth Advocacy. And I am over the moon excited about our show today, and I mean that. And I love when I feel that way because the passion is there for me. And we're going to be in conversation with two disruptors for good, which can also be translated as troublemakers in a really good way. Julia Gabbard is the Associate Director of Major Gifts, and Mikhail Legend is the Associate Campaign Director for Corporate Accountability. And as I stated in my intro, this organization's purpose for being is really to wage strategic campaigns that compel transnational corporations and governments that do their bidding to stop destroying our health, human rights, and democracy in our planet. Corporate accountability is not just dreaming of a world rooted in justice where corporations answer to people, not the other way around. A world where every person has access to clean water, healthy food, a safe place to live, and the opportunity to reach their full human potential. And in these days of COVID-19, I, for one, when people ask me that know me really well, what's your word of the day? It's gratitude. Because all of those things that I just mentioned, clean water, healthy food, a safe place to live, and the opportunity to reach my full potential, I have always had them. And I don't take them for granted, and I know about white privilege, so they are important to me, and I'm aware how grateful I am and how blessed I am. So these people are working every day to make things better, to pull back the curtain on so many things that are wrong, just plain wrong. And I'm honored to have you both here to tell us more because I can't think of any time in my entire life where what you are doing matters more. So that's my big, warm Mrs. Green's World welcome to both of you. So thanks for being here.
That was so sweet.
So Julia, you and I have been in conversation quite a bit. We hit it off from hello. We were really excited about a big event that was planned for Tucson that was just postponed, not canceled, for now due to COVID-19. And I've also read a great deal about the important work of corporate accountability. So let's start with, can you articulate some of the really important concepts that drive you? And I would say it's the place from which you come as an organization. Why don't we start there?
Absolutely. Gina, thanks for having us on here today. So corporate accountability really started 40 years ago when we had the name INFACT for Infant Formula Action Coalition. There was a handful of students at the University of Minnesota who were inspired by Cesar Chavez and the United Farm Workers Movement. And when they heard about the fact that babies around the world were dying due to switching to infant formula, they recognized that they needed to do something. And it was a really powerful moment. We organized an international boycott, partnering with allies around the world to challenge the infant formula marketing practices. You know, there were marketers wearing doctors' and nurses' uniforms going into hospitals and going door to door in communities in parts of Latin America and Africa, and telling women to switch to formula and be a better mom. This is a modern woman. And it was it contributed to over 1 million deaths of babies around the world. And through our organizing, we helped organize the first successful international consumer boycott, which helped to shift the cost-benefit ratio for the corporation. So it cost them more to continue business as usual than to change their practices. And then we helped to lock in policy at the World Health Organization level to make sure that there's now a code of conduct of how corporations can market and sell their breast milk substitute, their infant formula. And I tell that story, Gina, because it really is kind of the blueprint, which how we think about our work these days. We run corporate campaigns that expose the practices of transnational corporations. And that concept of shifting the cost-benefit ratio absolutely guides our work today. We show up at shareholders meetings and call CEOs out. We show up at international policy negotiations. We represent our members in advocating for strong policies. We are basically everywhere we need to be, from town halls in cities across the United States to international climate treaty negotiations. And the emphasis here is really at every level of democracy and policy making to do whatever it takes to shift that cost-benefit ratio. And the policy we organize are for real solutions rooted in justice. And that all stems from building power amongst our allies from around the world to ensure that our calls are rooted in justice. And I think the other element, Gina, is that we name names. We're not afraid to call out the industries and specific corporations who are at the root of this crisis.
And it's different times. It's like the crisis continues, and now you layer on a pandemic. And of course, I think everything that's wrong in the world is related to climate change, or I can find a thread. So to me, my excitement and my enthusiasm in the intro and in having the time to do this is because your work is, in my opinion, more important now than ever. Not to diminish saving all the babies in the world that you probably have saved, because, as I say, formula was toxic swill as far as I was concerned when I got pregnant. I did a lot of research. I was like, no, breastfed is best fed. I used to say that to everybody. So you did that. Really focus a lot on big tobacco abuses and holding it liable, the fossil fuel industry. Mikkel, do you want to add to some of the areas of focus that you're working on? Because it's a long journey. It's not a one-time thing. You don't fix something and then it's over. They come back.
Yeah, that is absolutely right. I think that in the 25 years of our tobacco campaign, we've really been focused on monitoring, exposing, and challenging the deadly abuses of the biggest tobacco corporations as kind of a primary focus in the day-to-day and the week-to-week, and then securing and really driving the accomplishments of the Global Tobacco Treaty forward. And the Global Tobacco Treaty is really the guidelines and the rule book and the gold standard of how to basically implement public health policy in country. And so that has been a tool that we've really pushed to include these conflict of interest policies, which is enshrined in Article 5.3, and the liability work, which is enshrined in Article 19, and all these corporate accountability measures, small c, small a, and then work to support governments around the world in really implementing those in strong public health policy. So those two things have really been the driving force of how we have achieved success on tobacco. And what remains the main hurdle and impediment to the success of the Global Tobacco Treaty has and continues to be the tobacco corporations that are prioritizing their profit over public health and people.
You know, it comes down to me, I have to ask you a really tough question, since you're not afraid to call people out. And I'm not afraid to admit if I was misled or didn't do a deep enough dive. I want you to talk to me about McDonald's. And let me lay the groundwork. I read Bob Lenker's book, The Battle to Do Good. I talked to quite a few people that were involved in it for the supply chain. It's escaping me what organization they worked with to hold them accountable, which I had a lot of respect for. What are they up to? Did I get snowed? Because it seemed like they really did implement a lot of sustainable practices, and my love of the rainforest is second to none. So what are they doing?
Well, when it comes to McDonald's, they're really the core of our rotten food system. You know, they are the biggest purchaser of beef, potatoes, tomatoes, apples in the entire world. And when they make changes to their supply chain, it impacts the entire food system. So even if you're not eating from McDonald's, you're eating food that's created by the same system. A big part of our campaign against McDonald's is around their workers' rights, and also about the way that they market junk food to kids.
Got it.
Through things like Happy Meals and Ronald McDonald's, and perpetuating diet-related disease and getting kids hooked on sugar, salt, fat from a very young age. There's also a lot of there's a huge racial justice component to McDonald's and their marketing. For example, in Chicago, when they were seeking out places to put their stores, they had a really interesting map of all the places that they wanted to put their stores, which happened to be all close to schools. So, and in low-income neighborhoods and primarily Black communities and Brown communities. So there's a real and then who does diet-related disease impact the most in our country? Mostly Black people and Latino people. So there's a lot to be said about McDonald's. That's kind of the top headline. And I can say a little bit more about their ties to Coca-Cola and sugar, and also their role in influencing policy. But I don't know if Mikkel, you want to add anything to that?
No, I think you covered it.
Well, it's like I did not get duped, because they didn't address any of that, of course. They just addressed their supply chains and sustainable beef sourcing and their packaging and things like that. But you're right. I mean, it's like I'm addicted to McDonald's French fries and I don't go. You know what I mean? It's like, thank God, because I don't want to be morbidly obese, even in a post-COVID-19 world, in a COVID-19 world. But that kind of makes me feel better, because some of the things they did were good. But the bottom line is the entire place from which they come isn't. And I'm not afraid to call that out either. And it kind of segues perfectly, because let's talk about the pandemic a little bit, because you talked about it, Julia, about the obesity and all of that. And we're seeing numbers again that are so disturbing, where a disproportionate number of people are, brown or Black dying. And a lot of it has been tied to obesity. So what has your role been, or what did you do as a team when the pandemic really hit in terms of corporate leveraging? I mean, it's like a short time frame to move a mountain.
Absolutely. And I think the pandemic is something that our society is unraveling and unveiling the impacts of slowly and over time. And, our first response was to make sure our team, our allies around the world, were safe and they had a safe place to work. And we very quickly came together to figure out how we can contribute given our analysis and role in the world. And we began to monitor the response from the corporate world. And what we're seeing is pretty alarming. And I often seek the inspiration of others in this time. And Naomi Klein is somebody who I've been referencing quite a bit. She did shock doctrine several years ago, pointing to Hurricane Katrina and the impacts and unveiling of our systems in that time. And she really coined the phrase disaster capitalism. And that's when industries see a crisis like this pandemic and see dollar signs. It's the leveraging of the unrest in this political moment to advance the agenda, and the agenda of the industry, for example. And we see this in the fossil fuel industry quite a bit, right? Lobbying to roll back regulation and secure bailout money. And we've seen this in many, many industries as well, but that's just the one that is most prominent right now. Taking this moment and setting out, like, we need rollbacks in this moment. We can't possibly be adhering to EPA regulations in this pandemic. And it's agitating, because the climate crisis is going to be here long after this pandemic subsides.
That is such a great answer. I mean, it's like press pause here and say it's such a great answer. And to think about the pain and the suffering and the sorrow and the deaths, and then corporate greed rears its ugly head. It doesn't matter when or what the crisis is. Here they are. One of my really good friends just quit her career as someone working for the EPA. and we were on a Zoom call with a Cultivating Women's Leadership group. And she said, I just couldn't take it anymore. You know, it started with the fact that my boss was, forbidden to do any banking in the state of Oklahoma because he was found guilty on so many counts of fraud and all of these things. And that was her boss, who, trust me, did not have a big background in the environment. And she said the things that we were being asked to do, I mean, it was her career. It was her exit strategy, her plan for retirement. She said, I couldn't live with myself anymore. So, and that was just last Friday that I had that conversation with her. So let's segue into a little bit more in-depth conversation about your climate campaign. And I have a minimum of 20 questions in my head, but we can't make this a 3-hour interview. So let me try to roll them out one at a time. Tell me a little bit more about your climate campaign. And specifically, I'm interested in the work in the international policy realm when it comes to climate. And I know it's an area of expertise for you. So who wants to take that one, or both of you?
Our climate campaign is actually one of our newest campaigns. You know, for 5 years, we've been working at the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change. This is the big UN policymaking space that, you know, the world came together through the UN several years ago, 25 years ago, to say climate change is a global problem that requires a global solution. And when we first landed in this area, we were shocked. You know, there's no rules on the books for protecting the talks from the fossil industry. And the fossil fuel industry has been undermining these talks for decades. They're allowed to walk the halls. There's hundreds of lobbyists stand there in plain clothes, talking to delegates and undermining policy. And this has been going on for 25 years. And December was the 25th conference of the party. Every year they have a conference of the parties to craft how the world is going to respond to this crisis. And what's so frustrating, Gina, is that people, the very people from the crisis are sitting at the negotiating table. It's like, this is a classic example of the fox guarding the hen house. They are crafting the policy that their industry will then have to adhere to. In concept, it's frustrating, right? And then when we show up in spaces, 5 years ago, we started shopping around this idea and we say, okay, let's take on the biggest industry in human history. And at first, we were getting glances from different allies and government delegates saying, what? No way. How we can't possibly challenge the role of the fossil fuel industry. But over just the past few years, we've been able to organize this representing 70% of the world population to do something at the same time the U.S. and the EU blocked policy unjustly would have stopped the conversation from moving forward. So this kind of movement is taking on momentum, and it's significant, right? Because it involves so many people and it's justice oriented. Some of the youth groups have started taking on the Polluters Out campaign, and the whole premise of the campaign, I should say, is to kick big polluters out of policymaking and make them pay for the damages that they've caused. How are we going to solve this climate crisis? We're going to need a little money, right? So why not have the industry that was at the heart of this crisis, who knew for decades about the damages they were cause, pay for the real solutions that are possible? So we're working to lock in policy at the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change and build a movement to make it harder for the fossil fuel industry to interfere at every level.
Can you just have like this minute, everybody who's listening, to think about how the fossil fuel industry was doing the happy dance in the last election, like walking around saying, woohoo, woohoo, we're back in, and there's not going to be anything to stop us. It's like, it's so scary and it's so short-sighted. That's the part that we can't even go off on that tangent, because it hurts everyone. No one is exempt for the damage they do. When I first found out that the gas companies were, they were not mandated to follow the Clean Water Act. They were exempt. I was like, what? So they can go in and frack and do whatever the frack they want, and there they go. So, yeah, you're going to make me sleep better at night. So what kind of impact, you kind of mentioned it a little bit, and Mikkel, sorry, I want to know, was there anything you wanted to add to what Julia had to say?
No, but I'm looking forward to where this next question's going.
Well, the question is, I keep trying in my own head, heart, being, to think that some good will have to come out of the COVID-19. It's a hard place for me to go, but I want to. So will the COVID-19, do you see some positive possibilities? First of all, will people finally realize that we are a global society? It's not a land with borders. It's like a global economy and it travels. So what do you all see as taking this as an opportunity to go forth and conquer, or is there one?
Yeah, I feel like that is such an important question in this moment. And I think it's one that many in the movements for justice are grappling with. And I think the word that you used is really important. It's an opportunity, right? There's nothing that's guaranteed in any of these moments. But the opportunity in front of us is to really shift how we look at history, how we take lessons from the past, and how we change our approach in the now. What we're seeing is a very global North dominant narrative. A lot of resources, a lot of attention, a lot of media in the global North when it comes to COVID-19. And the lesson learned there is that there's a big similarity in the way that we have approached the climate crisis. That we've dominated the landscape with attention and resources when things are happening in the global North, and many times left out of that discussion are the particular communities in the global North that are disproportionately impacted, and then an entire region of the world, the global South, of people that are facing the most direct impacts with the fewest resources to address these crises. And so there's an opportunity to really look back and reflect on our history and all the systems and structures that have been built to constantly site and zone some of the worst refineries near brown and black populations in the U.S., and also how we've moved most of the most toxic industrialization manufacturing into the global South. And I think there's also a conversation to be had about how we create solidarity and how, as a movement, we move from a place of individual consumption and individual impact to a place of how does this affect the globe? How do we think about a movement that is accommodating as many people in the lifeboat as possible? We've got a really significant hurdle in terms of what we're facing in terms of the COVID crisis and the climate crisis, but we also have a pretty major opportunity to shift drastically who we blame and who has the responsibility, which are the exacerbating factors of how corporations are gaming these disasters and the payouts that they're getting in the midst of the struggles that people are going through, and the solidarity that people are building right now in moments when many governments are not really focused on the impact directly on people. So it's a huge question. And I think it might be a cop-out to say opportunity is our biggest takeaway, but it truly is. We have a really big moment in front of us about how we as a global community come together and move our governments to be responsible and to take the action that is truly necessary in this moment.
See, I think that's a great answer, just a great answer. And I invite the listeners, all of my wonderful, amazing tribe, to like press pause and let that sink in, because it's not going to be an opportunity. We are going to be the ones to bring good things to come about by taking advantage of these opportunities and the myriad of forms that looks like. So I thought that was a great answer. I was spellbound. So Julia, do you have anything you want to answer to that? Can you top that?
Well, it's good that Mikkel and I aren't competitive because I cannot top that. But I think the one thing that I would add is just, and Mikkel started to touch on this, like there's an opportunity of collectivism here that, you know, we, especially as Americans, are very focused on our individualistic society and what we're doing, staying home, taking every precaution in this COVID-19 crisis is really an opportunity to reestablish connection with people, to talk about ourselves as a collective in our society, to take actions, not for the benefit of you as an individual, but for the benefit of a society. And I do think there's also this opportunity that proves that we can act if there is political will. You know, there's dramatic actions that can be taken. I'm thinking of the climate crisis, if there's the political will to make it happen.
Right.
And there's this level of ambition that we're seeing here, some governments more than other, that could be applied to the climate crisis and what is possible has been demonstrated, and how do we leverage that power for when this pandemic is over to actually make real meaningful action on climate change happen?
Yeah, the operative word there being two words, collective and meaningful, in Trumpville. So let's go there. I have observed since Trump was elected, there's a lot of announcements about climate action from corporations and we're doing this and blah, 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 blah. And sometimes I feel without knowing that, like, just say CSR, it's a nice piece of literature, sometimes fiction that's on someone's website. But is this something positive? Does your organization see these announcements about climate action from corporations? Are they really stepping up for the greater good or not? Tell me the truth, you guys. You speak the truth.
Wow. I mean, go ahead, Mikkel.
Sorry. Yeah, I was just going to say, I think in short, none of these solutions that are proposed measure up to the action that needs to happen globally. And what we really need is leadership from every single country to step up and address the crisis with real solutions. And we know that the package of policies that we've been promoting will shift drastically how the conversation happens at the climate negotiations. Imagine policies when the profit-driven motives of the fossil fuel industry isn't part of the conversation, or imagine what it would look like if the solutions from indigenous communities and from global south communities are at the forefront of the policies and not things like carbon markets or net zero recommendations. I think those drastically change at that level. And also, I think it really does allow for like a great public image for these corporations more than anything else. They do the bare minimum and commit to the bare minimum, and voluntarily so, on timelines that are not succinct with what is being recommended. And on top of that, they get to chart what the solution is for. And we have little to no time to waste on any alleged solution forward with corporate interest or with a profit-driven motive. So I think that's like my initial response to that. I don't know if Julia has anything else to add.
Yeah, I would say that, you know, we do see a lot of corporations making a series of commitments around climate change and their future. You know, we're going to do X by 2030. We're going to do Y in the next two decades. And some may be well-meaning, but we know that we need government action. Corporate action cannot take the place of national leadership. And corporate action and corporate social responsibility actions can take away political will. If the industry thinks there's going to be some regulation coming their way, they might go ahead and make some voluntary commitments to in advance to kind of subside that. And these commitments, the voluntary commitments, are unenforceable, right? Governments need to step in and mandate corporations to act, and it really cannot be the other way around. And, you know, when we're talking about some of these, we're kind of talking in broad strokes about what corporations are doing. I'm thinking of, in the international climate policy level, carbon markets. It's a hot topic these days. It's something the industry really wants. It's the idea of ensuring that Global North Corp companies are able to keep polluting at the same rate and having different credits that other countries would or would not be able to, they would sell off their credits, essentially. And it does not keep the fossil fuels in the ground. It's a false solution in that it doesn't actually reduce the number of emissions. It's inherently racist in the way that we're talking about how Global North companies get the chance, Global North countries get the chance to keep polluting, and the growth of nations in Africa and Latin America are meant to not pollute as much and thus deplete their growth as a government, as a country. So I think when someone like Bill McKibben has spoken about this in the past, he said, you know what, these ideas, these half measures, these false solutions are things that would have been great to play around with in the early 90s or the 80s.
Right, right.
But it's 2020 and we do not have time to mess around with these kinds of things. We need to keep it in the ground. We need to make sure that people have access to just and equitable solutions. And we need to make sure that people are the ones demanding those solutions and are driving those solutions forward.
Great answers. I have one more question of both of you and then a question about how we can support your organization. But I get very discouraged, and I admit it. Sometimes I feel like the unsuccessful David in the David and Goliath story, and it's around hope. How do we hold corporations accountable? Don't they get it? The committee in my head gets really noisy at times, saying, what kind of difference do you think you're making? And blah, 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 blah. So I want to ask you both the personal question, because of the work that you do and being on the lines every day. Do you have hope? How's that for landing a bombshell question? But I really want to know from each of you, do you have hope?
Gina, I think that's a question I grapple with daily. And it's a roller coaster, you know? Some days I'm extremely hopeful.
Thank you.
And some days I am down in the doldrums and the doom overcomes me. Absolutely. And I think that I do have hope. It's what inspires me to keep going. And I think, you know, a couple weeks into this crisis, I was really down in the dumps and I needed to figure out what was going to motivate me to keep going. And what it was just a recognition that people have power, right? And we have an opportunity to use that power and leverage it to make change. And I saw this really sweet post the other day that's like, mourn and organize, right? We can be sad, we can be devastated about the state of the world, but we can channel that energy towards changing it. And I've personally just been inspired by the youth, the indigenous communities, the young people, and the people around the world whose everyday life is much more challenging than my own. And the way that they are leading on these solutions, they are organizing people like they've never before. The organization that we work really closely with, the coalition, the Global Campaign to Demand Climate Justice, is a group of hundreds of organizations around the world. And they're working to demand a global response to the COVID-19 crisis, a list of demands that's universal around people around the world to demand this, to make sure there's justice in this moment. So I do find inspiration through other people, but it is a daily battle.
That's such an honest answer, and thank you. It's like we're having the human experience, let's face it. And this gives me hope. When you talk about the impact you've had on formula and the impact you've had on tobacco, history can be an indicator of future changes. So places like a corporate accountability, knowing that all of you are doing the work you're doing, and these interviews, that's what gives me hope. Mikkel, what do you have hope, or would you rather be no comment?
Yeah, it would be easy to go no comment, but I think for the sake of being human, it's probably better to be honest. And I think Julia kind of summed it up really well. It's like a daily struggle where humans, and as like the more empathetic and sympathetic that you become, I think the more that you take on in terms of what the world is facing. But I think it's really important to sit with the humanity that you exist in. It's important to sit with the sadness that these moments bring about. It's important to find joy in the struggle, and it's important to feel connected when it's very isolating. And for me, I think I'm a bit of a weirdo that I find a lot of beauty and nuance. And when I reflect on the moment that we're in, it's really easy to become caught up in the corporate cycle, right? The quarter to quarter. Like, how do we figure out the next 3 months? How do we make ourselves feel the best over the next 3 months? It's really easy to get caught up in the news cycle, which is daily. But when you take a really big step back and you look at the long arc of history, there's so many giants that have stood up in terms of organizing and have gone up against the titans of our world and have still come out morally in on the right side of history. And sometimes they've won. And it's easy to remember the wins, but all that it took to get to that win is just as important. And I find a lot of hope in, you know, the youth movements right now, especially the youth movements that are from the environmental justice communities, those frontline groups, the folks that are dealing with the complex intersection of poverty and access to resources and health and the climate crisis. I find a lot of hope in the indigenous communities and the folks that have been really struggling for 25 plus years at the international stage to get the Global South perspective in the room. And they've done an amazing job keeping that at the forefront. And so, yeah, I think it's really a lot of people that have helped ride the wave of hope for me. And I do really think that when we look at history and we really reflect on it in totality, there's so many beautiful moments that if we thought about what we need to get done in the next 3 months, we'd lose out on the wins we can have in 2 years. And that really is important for me right now.
Another just great answer from your heart, and so helpful for me that is looking for inspiration every day. And I have a quote, because I got a very disturbing, long email from a person that was a part of our tribe that, you know, was calling me a hypocrite because I've been getting much more vocal, especially on my personal Facebook page, about Donald Trump. And, you know, she said I was a hypocrite because our tagline was, "We don't tell you what to think, we just want you to," which is a great tagline. But now I'm trying to tell people what they should think, or at least really you should be thinking about this. And somebody gave me that quote from Dante, and I'm not going to say that I believe in hell, because probably I don't. But the quote was so powerful to me because it said the darkest places in hell are reserved for those who maintain their neutrality in times of moral crisis. And what we are living now is a moral crisis. So to me, that's a perfect segue to say, to ask you, how do we best support your organization? And not just financially, there's probably things we can do. And I want to weave into every podcast I do, the one thing that every person listening to this can do is vote. That's the most important thing that everybody has to keep remembering. But I know financial support would be great. But do you have anything to add? All those links will be on the podcast page so that people can. And if one person makes a monthly pledge, I'll be happy. So what would you say besides that? I mean, I would call to people. $5 a month can help a lot, especially if 100 people listen to this do it. But what would each one of you, if you want to care to comment, tell us what we can do to really help us move more towards a socially just and sustainable planet? That's another big question on which to end, but it's got to be asked. What's the call to action?
you know, there's a lot that we need people to do. And we are a organization that is membership powered, and we rely on our members to enable us to be effective in our organizing. So it's very much a people powered organization. And the best thing people can do is sign up on our website just to get in our newsletter, to hear action alerts, and be ready to call your member of Congress to take action at any given time. In the next couple of weeks, we're organizing to ensure that the fourth stimulus package at the federal level includes moratoria on water shutoffs and utility shutoffs, really essential things for people in their everyday life at a moment when they're being asked to wash their hands every day and take care of themselves. People's water is being shut off because they can't afford to pay. We're also calling for no fossil fuel bailouts in this one, in the same infrastructure stimulus bill that we imagine is coming up in the next several weeks. We're asking folks to get involved and reach out. We need people. We need more people with us. We need people hosting house parties like we're going to do someday, Gina.
We are. It's going to be a big one.
Yeah. And it's going to be a really powerful one, because when people come together in community and can ask questions and relate to one another and what needs to be done, we grow stronger and we can make a lot happen together. So I would say those are the two biggest things. Join us online and find out how you can take more action. All of our actions are very timely, so I don't want to project too far out without knowing exactly when folks will be hearing this. And then find ways to reach out to your member of Congress and take action related to the moratorium on water shutoffs. And if you are a corporation or own a corporation, the best thing you can do is pay your taxes and stay out of policymaking.
Okay. And I think what we should do is add on that list when we post the show a way to just directly sign up for the newsletter, because there are things that people can do that don't cost any money, but that can help bring about change. So, Mikkel, I think she covered it. Is there any other thing that popped into your head that you think needs to be added? Because that was really a way for engagement.
Yeah, I think that is like a lot of the stuff in the most immediate and really clear, like actionable next step. I think one thing to foreshadow is that we're working with our allies in the global campaign to demand climate justice to prepare what is the response from the global community to COVID-19 and how to support better equipping global South governments to face this crisis. And so that's a bunch of climate justice groups from around the world that are coming together to support a really justice-oriented response to COVID-19 and as a marker for how we should be responding to the climate crisis as well. So that's going to be an amazing solidarity opportunity that folks should also look out for. And you'll probably see in the newsletter when it comes out.
And I don't think, shame on me, I don't think I signed up for the newsletter. So I can say the one action I'm going to take as soon as I get off the podcast is to go to the computer and make sure that I have signed up, because I want to walk the walk. And one of the things I love about this podcast is that I get the last word. So here it is. Clearly, I love everything about this organization, Corporate Accountability, and their work. They give me hope when I really need things to give me hope these days. It makes me feel better as a human being just knowing that Corporate Accountability exists and that they are out there being disruptors for good, holding big money corporations accountable, bringing us to a place of positive, socially just, and sustainable change, because they are about real, substantive, systemic change. And I hope that you, my wonderful listeners, tribal members, are as inspired by this podcast as I've been, and that you will feel so inspired that you will listen to what Mikkel and Julia had to say about taking one single action that you can do to up your game, pump up the volume, let your voice be heard, because the planet needs us. And those without voices need us maybe even more. So Julia and Mikkel, thanks so much for showing up in my world, for crossing in my life's paths. And I know that this won't be the last of our conversations. And it's very clear to you, I'm sure, that I appreciate you and all your organization does to make my world a better one. And my final thanks is always the same. It's thanks to you, our listeners, because without you, there would be no us. So go out there and make some noise. So thank you both. And here's my vision. This just came in. I have a thing where I point to my head and I say, this just in. I hope that we can have a conversation in maybe 9 months from now that is all about hope, because there's been a big change in the conversation in the United States of America, not just at the national level and who's got the heads in the beds in the White House, but who is our congressional delegation. Our state elections are so important in a place like Arizona. So thank you both for doing what you do and for taking this time and for showing up in my world.